Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Pope Benedict XVI's message for the World Day of the Sick. 6 years of grace, one person's witness in caring for her terminally ill mother. What drives a Benedictine abbess? And our Latin lover tells how the Emperor Claudius might have viewed Lourdes. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. On the 11th of February 2007, to coincide with the liturgical memory of Our Lady of Lourdes, the Church is celebrating the 15th World Day of the Sick in Korea's capital, Seoul. This day, dedicated to those who suffer, was on Pope Benedict XVI's mind on Friday when he received an audience in the Vatican a group of finance ministers from across the world and other prominent personalities engaged in a project by the title of Advance Market Commitment, a project aimed at developing and producing vaccines against pandemic diseases and indeed making them available to poorer countries. My colleague Philippa Hitchin will be telling you more about this at this same time on Monday's broadcast. But getting back to the 2007 World Day of the Sick, Pope Benedict's message, which was released back in December, focused in a special way on encouraging the efforts of those who work daily to ensure that the incurably and terminally ill, together with their families, receive adequate and loving care. The Church, the Pope stressed, should follow the example of the Good Samaritan in showing particular concern for those who suffer. He called for just social policies which can help eradicate the cause of many diseases and the improved care for those who are dying. The sick, he pointed out, should be offered the human assistance and spiritual accompaniment they need, describing it as a right belonging to every human being, one which we must all be committed to defend. Pope Benedict also highlighted how through her individual members and institutions, the Church continues to stand alongside the suffering and to attend the dying, striving to preserve their dignity at these significant moments of human existence. Individuals, healthcare professionals, pastoral agents, volunteers, and of course institutions throughout the world are tirelessly serving the sick in hospitals and in palliative care units, on city streets, in housing projects, and parishes. One person who has first-hand experience in providing loving care to a parent who suffered a crippling stroke is Jennifer Sokol, a violinist in the Seattle area of the United States. She recently recounted that experience in a book which she entitled 6 Years of Grace, Caregiving Episodes with My Mother. 6 years then, during which Jennifer gave up her job and cared for her mother precisely from 1992 until her death in 1998. Susie Hodges asked her about that caregiving experience.
I was approached by several people during the last few years I cared for my mother, who encouraged me to write a story because they were inspired about what I was doing for her, and they thought it was a story that other people should hear about.
How easy was it for you to embark on this experience of caring for your mother after she had her crippling stroke? Did you, in some ways, kick against the traces at first?
Yes, I did. I had never taken on this full-time kind of responsibility of care before, although I had cared for the elderly. But this was a shock both for Mom, for Dad, and myself because of her condition. It was so serious, and so I really had to dig deeply within myself to really answer that call.
Tell me, what were some of the most difficult moments during those 6 years of caring for your mother, some of the incidents that really stand out?
Well, in general, it's very difficult to observe a parent who's sick and, you know, you have to watch their condition diminish from day to day. And that was very emotionally draining for me. But also to see how hard she worked to try and walk again through the various therapies that we tried and the therapists that we worked through, and to come to that acceptance that someday she really never would recover was very difficult.
And how important was prayer in this experience?
Well, it became the lifeline for both she and I because it provided a foundation of hope for us that we could look to God who was above and beyond everything that we were going through, and that no matter what, in Mom's condition, she had that hope that she would have eternal life someday and that we would find the grace and light we needed for each day until that time.
And what prayers did you use?
We were very much centered in our relationship with Mary, God's mother. So Mom daily prayed the rosary. She had her own kind of meditations that she enjoyed. She liked to enjoy scripture readings. But I think mainly it was those spontaneous outpourings to Mary, where you just share your questions and concerns with her in, within, and you gently feel her guidance.
You say that there was a lot of humor. Now, that's something that could surprise many people who would consider this to be quite a sort of grim and emotionally draining prospect. Can you give us some examples of these humorous moments?
Well, we had various therapists come into the home who worked with Mom before she was able to go outside for outpatient therapy. And some of those therapists provided a lot of humor just because of their unusual techniques that they described. And also, we got into some predicaments with having to get her to swimming pool therapy, which at first was very awkward. But in retrospect, we were actually able to look back and laugh.
And you said about this therapist and the things they did to make you laugh. Can you again give an example there?
Well, it's hard to imagine, but one therapist thought that by rubbing an ice cube up and down Mom's left shin, that that would somehow fire her brain back into activity. And the whole thing was really ridiculous. It didn't work, and it ended up being a total failure.
What were the most important things, though, that this experience as a caregiver taught you?
The most important things were relationship. That no matter what, you have to bring this deep sense of caring for that person that you're with and entering into a deep friendship with them, which brings forth an untold amount of love that you never knew was possible by being present to somebody in their suffering and seeing the light of hope that that gives to them. And then also the deepening of faith that this whole experience can bring, again, through suffering, that you never could have imagined.
And this may be in some ways related, but what do you think are the main things that the sick can teach us?
The sick are so vulnerable, and they just show us that no matter how self-sufficient and strong we feel, we really are all very weak, and we are in need of God, and that they teach us that we have to get out of ourselves and reach out to them in their great need and show them that they are loved and accepted even in their sickness and diminished situation.
And of all this reader feedback that you've been getting, have there been any particular ones that have been particularly memorable or poignant that have stuck in your mind?
I heard back from a nurse who worked in a hospital for over 35 years. And still, by reading this book, she learned things about home care that she had never realized. And it helped her as a professional medical person to enhance her own medical knowledge of what home care and how that differs from hospital care. And also just from people who have done similar things that I have, but they need somebody else's story to offer them inspiration and hope.
That was Jennifer Sokol, author of 6 Years of Grace, Caregiving Episodes with My Mother, speaking there to Susie Hodges. And now moving on in the broadcast, last week, to mark the day the Church dedicates to consecrated life, I shared with you a conversation with a Benedictine, the abbot of St. Paul's outside the walls, Edmund Power. This week I'd like to follow up on that interview by speaking to another Benedictine, this time a consecrated woman, an abbess, who draws inspiration not just from Saint Benedict, but also from Saint Scholastica, whose feast day falls on February the 10th each year. Stay tuned. Is there any Benedictine woman who inspires you in particular?
Scholastica.
So Benedict's sister?
Twin sister, yes. Pope Gregory shows how she was stronger than him because she loved more. And I think that is a message from a woman for us women today, which is very inspiring.
The voice of the abbess in question, Moira Hickey, superior of a Benedictine monastery in Germany, dedicated to Saint Scholastica. Abbess Moira highlights there the figure of Scholastica as a model of love. But she also highlights the key role of the saint's twin brother, Benedict, and indeed his rule in guiding the daily life of her community. Although clearly a few things might just need chucking out after a millennium and a half.
There's hardly anything I would throw out. There are some things about accepting children into the monastery, 5 years of age. Parents did sometimes bring very young children into the monastery. They were brought up to become monks or nuns later on. I wouldn't do that anymore. And there are recommendations about corporal punishment for these children if they are not behaving.
Leaving the negative aspects aside, Abbess Moira also touched on the areas of the rule she deems most significant, those where Benedict focuses on spiritual teaching. And on my request, she spoke about the liturgy and prayer life of her community. Benedict was very strong on the liturgy, you know? There's a reassuring ritual to your day.
That's right. He did say, come together 7 times a day to praise God. And that in your everyday life, nothing is more important than this. Everything, you drop everything and go into church when the bell rings. Every monastery has time every day for reading the Bible or other spiritual books in order to have to feed one's mind with the story of the Bible, story of salvation and God's love for the world, so that our relationship to him is growing all the time with many ups and downs. But that occupies a large part of our time every day. It's different in every monastery. In our monastery, it's about 4.5 hours a day.
You make a monastic profession now, where you mention words like stability, conversion, and obedience. May I ask you a personal question? Which was the most difficult to accept?
The most difficult one for me at the time when I made it was obedience.
How old were you?
Oh, I wasn't young. I was 38. And I had got used to being independent and making my own choices. And it was quite clear to me that that would be very limited and different. And I didn't know how I was going to be able to cope with that.
So which was the easiest then to live out?
I suppose conversion, yes, I suppose that was the most attractive one in a way, because it was, in the word itself, conversion, it promises transformation and growing to fulfillment. I was very much drawn to that. But it is just as demanding from day to day.
That's the vocation that brings you to the conversion. No? I would be attracted by the stability.
Yes. At the time when I joined the monastery, I had enjoyed travelling around quite a lot. And I wasn't very keen on giving that up. But I realised I was going to have to. I think nowadays life has got so mobile that people feel the need for stability even more than they did 30 years ago when I joined the monastery. I noticed that from many people who come, that they are mobile more than they can bear a lot of the time.
How much contact do you have with the outside world in your monastery? I mean, real contact.
In my own monastery? Well, we live at the edge of a small town in North Germany. We have a guest house, about 25, 26 rooms. They are nearly always full of people, mostly Catholics, but not by any means all. Very many Protestants and very many people who are Christian but haven't found a satisfying way of practicing and are looking for a way of practicing.
Benedict's rule begins with the words, listen, no?
The people share with you their own lives.
Lots of time every day listening to people talking. We have, a little bit apart from the guest house, a shelter for people who have nowhere to go, and there are usually at least three or four homeless people or people who have lost what they have or run into difficult times staying there. There's two sisters who are responsible for them, and they are sharing with them all the time. People from the town come very often, troubles they have and problems. Oh, there's no escape from all of that. We wouldn't want to. And we all have our families, and every family has its share of reality. And
you share your family lives within the community?
Much more than we used to. They're all very welcome to visit us.
Pope Benedict says we should all do is think positive, in a sense, in our faith, no?
I think so.
Think in joyful terms.
Yes, I think so. We're aware of the problems very much, but we are, I think, just rejoicing in Christian life, and as Pope Benedict has been telling us to contemplate the beauty of God, and I think that is getting across to us. I think many Europeans of my generation have been so educated to be critical, to think before one says yes to anything, to put a lot of energy into picking it apart and criticizing it. And I think we have been realizing that it's good to learn how to do that, but one spends one life using up a lot of energy in something that is negative, and rejoicing in the positive things and rejoicing in life and God and what he is doing for us.
Our thanks there go to Abbess Myra Hickey, Superior of the Abbey of St. Scholastica at Dinklage in Germany. And finally, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who this week focuses on the Emperor Claudius, his lame leg, and much more. Watch the change of pace and tone.
The Romans, how did they consider their health? Did they consider it as something precious?
They would have considered it, the way Cicero talks and all these other people talk, as something kind of natural. Things just happen. I mean, you're well, and you take care of yourself, and you're good, and then you get sick, and some people are sick, and they die, you know? Something precious, eh. They always say, vale, take care of yourself. But I don't think they had this obsession as we have today.
Did they care for each other?
Yeah, that's all right, in the family and everything else. But when things happen, like babies dying, you know, we just don't hear any kind of reaction.
For example, Claudius, the Emperor Claudius, no?
Mm-hmm.
He was described by Suetonius as having weak knees, which gave way under him while his head shook.
Yeah, poor Claudius.
He's how do you friend, say that in
he's
Latin?
He's a good friend of mine. Huh?
Yeah, how do you say all that in Latin? His knees were weak.
Genibus debilibus.
And gave way under him, and his head shook.
Cedentibus. Genibus debilibus ac cedentibus. Or cedentibus et capite nescio volutante.
They had it in for him because Suetonius went on to say that he stammered and his speech was confused.
Yes, yes.
He slobbered and his nose ran when excited.
That's terrible.
That's getting personal, though, isn't it? How do you say that, getting too personal about the Emperor Claudius?
Nemium ingredimur in animum. We're getting more into his spirit. Nemium ingredimur in animum.
The Emperor Claudius would have resented this kind of description
of his
face.
Well, the poor man, he realized he was born that way. He was born deformed. And he had this, you know, kind of like a, what do you say, dried up leg. And he hobbled around for his whole life. And he did stammer. Everyone knows that. But the fact he was a brilliant man. His head was wonderful.
Okay, how do you say? The Emperor Claudius hobbled around.
Bene, bene, claudicabat ubique Claudius. Quamquam caput... Bene agebat, although his head was doing well.
Now, I know that the emperors liked to go to thermal baths, and some of these thermal baths were presumably curative baths, no?
Mm.
We have them all over,
all over
the former Roman Empire.
The
They believed in curative effects of water, no?
Oh, yeah. Well, fine, fair enough. Like the doctor would say, when you get in a bathtub or put your legs in warm water, you know.
How'd you say that?
Crura immerge aquam in calidam. Put your legs in warm water.
But you didn't say the word doctor, though.
Medice.
So they had doctors.
Oh, certainly they had. Most of them were Greek doctors. So, but the fact is they had just... And they always said the famous proverb in Roman stuff was, you know, the doctor would say, well, this sickness, if it's not curable, it was fatal. Well, that's not saying very much, you know.
So how do you say that?
Si curare non poterat, erat fatalis.
Were there a lot of emperors who had deformed bodies?
No, I don't think become deformed. No. Claudius was, the most outstanding example of this. And you see statues of him. I can show you in a museum. And he's kind of hobbled over. And you see one of his legs is kind of dried up. Atrophy or whatever you call it. Cerebral problem. Something.
Some words in Latin to describe that?
All kinds of words. And he's hanging over there, and the fact is he had this problem. And if you watch your British movie, I, Claudius... Yes,
inspired by Robert Graves.
Volumes there, which is out of this world. And the fact is he's going around the house up there on the Palatine Hill, kind of hobbling, and they made fun of him, that he was dribbling and hobbling and everything else, and he became emperor for 13 years.
So, he was dribbling and hobbling, and he became emperor for how many years? 13?
13 anos imperator fuit. Etiam distillans labius. Dribbling from his lips, labius et, what are you going to say, balbutiens, and stammering. No, he's a darling man, and he's now being rehabilitated. Because he was not an evil man. He was a very intelligent man, but he looked like an idiot.
Mm. Well, talking about looking like idiots, the Romans would not have been people to expose weakness and admit to dependence, no?
No, not too much.
Mm. And would they have believed in collective healing?
No.
No. How does one say collective healing? Like, for example, in Lourdes.
Oh, no. Sanatio universalis. That would be collective healing. No, they wouldn't believe in that at all. Mm. And the only reason why Claudius was made emperor, you know that, was by a joke. Because when Caligula was killed, then the Praetorian guards went up to this house and they were looking around and they found Claudius in a closet, hiding. Really?
Hiding.
He was hiding. And they said, well, let's make this kind of buffoon. Let's make this clown the emperor. And they did. And he stayed for 13 years. But it was a joke.
Okay, well, you have to translate this for me now. hiding in a closet.
Ergo, deli te shebat in receptaculo.
And?
Quem repererunt whom they found.
Mm-hmm.
Atque per jocum, by means of a joke, per jocum, imperatorem creare statuerunt. They decided to make him emperor per jocum, by a joke. And ita factus est imperator tradici manos.
So he was made fun of because he had these physical
faults. Well, yeah, they
faults.
Thought he was an idiot, but the fact is he wasn't. He was very studious and he learned all kinds of things.
At any rate, he lived long before an anti-clerical guy called Emile Zola, and he described Lourdes this way. And I think that maybe Claudius would have agreed. As some 100 patients passed through the same water, you can imagine what a horrible slop it was at the end.
Ergo, centum infirmi periandem transierunt aquam.
There was everything
potestis in it. Fingere, you can imagine. Potestis fingere. Quae fuerit ad extremum. The word. Quae fuerit ad extremum. Sordes.
Okay. There was everything in it. Scabs, bits of cloth.
Oh,
bandage,
my lord.
An abominable soup of ills. Well, maybe we can leave out the scabs, etc.
Yeah, I would say
just
so.
An abominable soup of ills.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How
yeah.
do you say that?
Abominabila complexio malorum.
The miracle was that anyone emerged alive from this slime.
Miraculum id fuit quod quicumque ex hoc limo from this slime, from limo is slime, ex hoc limo emerzit iam sanatus erat. He was safe.
So anyway, the Romans, none of the Romans in general would have appreciated a place like Lourdes because they didn't believe in miracles,
no,
right?
No, not that kind of stuff. No, and, they didn't. No, they didn't. Huh? No, really, universally, no.
So collecting...
They would call on individual gods and maybe pray like we pray today.
Because the Gospel of Lourdes, in a way, is the story of the paralytic from Luke's Gospel, no?
Yeah. Yeah.
No? Was lowered.
That's in the baths of there in Jerusalem.
Yeah. These miracles.
The Romans wouldn't.
They were too matter of fact, the Romans.
Yeah, they wouldn't. They would say, well, what's that all about? They wouldn't understand it.
The word miracle, though, is of Latin origin.
A miraculum is something to be wondered at. Miror, mirare is to wonder or to admire or to be surprised at. So miraculum is an event to be surprised at. That's a miracle. Or to be wondered at.
So despite the fact that they don't believe in miracles, the words used for miracle is
theirs. Still on full blast.
Warm thanks, as always, to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.